Our next presenter will be Rob Roy. Rob is visiting us from Putnam County, New York, which, if anybody is not sure where Putnam County is, about an hour and 20-minute train ride north of the city. He is there practicing private practice in general psychiatry, and he's the medical director of a mental health clinic in Putnam County. He's married to a clinical psychologist. He has three very bright and talented girls. He says, but of course, all of our children are bright and talented. And he wants to everybody to know that his talk will not be about the male genital urinary system, so anybody who was thinking that was the case may leave for a little while if you'd like and get some coffee. He's going to be mainly talking about engaging men and the fragile male ego in psychologically stressful situations for them. He hopes that this will be a fun talk for us. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you. All right, good morning. And I have no conflicts to report on any level, hopefully. First, a note about the title of my talk. As Phil said, it is not about urology, at least not in the literal sense. My wife, who is a clinical psychologist and with whom I practice, noticed that I had a way with men who were my patients. She would marvel at how at ease they were in becoming with me. One of us, I forgot which, described the initial work with a new male patient using terms involving the examination of the prostate. Our children have exhibited many a puzzled look when my wife and I discuss my latest prostate case. Can everyone read? There's no shortage of theoretical underpinnings that drive the practice of psychology and psychiatry. It is possible to subscribe to a specific school of thought, Freudian, Jungian, etc., but most people develop an amalgam of many theories which fit the practitioner's cognitive style and temperament. My own work most closely approximates the theories of Carl Rogers. The Rogerian approach focuses on careful, active listening to the patient and reflecting back in an unvarnished way. If the patient feels both understood and listened to, an environment is created which allows the person to feel comfortable enough to express their fears and insecurities without fear of judgment and ridicule. You only think you're barking at nothing. We're all barking at something. Andrew was assigned to me in my third year of residency as a long-term psychotherapy patient. I was to see him twice a week and to get 1 hour of supervision solely about his case. Andrew had been diagnosed with schizoid personality disorder, which manifested in his having very little eye contact and an apparent inability to connect emotionally with those around him, including me. While he spoke rather freely about the issues contributing to and surrounding his feelings of anxiety, and similarly about what appeared to be mundane details of his daily life, he did it in a distant, detached manner, as if he were reporting all of this to the air. It was a challenge to try to conceptualize what help I could actually expect to give to Andrew, but it was clear that my essential job as I got to know him was to listen to him attentively and give my own mind free rein to make tentative connections as to what was plaguing him. After a number of sessions, there came one session during which, for reasons unknown, I started to daydream, probably for no more than 10 seconds. When I came to, Andrew had stopped talking and was staring at me. When I refocused my attention on him, he angled sideways, his usual position with me, and continued his stream of daily details. During another session, Andrew told me about his theory that the white lines on some of his fingernails were caused by a zinc deficiency, and that these lines were distressing to him. As a well-trained McGill graduate, I chose to respond directly to the content of what he was saying, and I replied, "You know, Andrew, I'm not sure what causes those lines, but I don't think it has to do with zinc deficiency." Andrew paused, continued to not make eye contact, and continued talking about issues except those related to his zinc theory. In supervision that week, I dutifully recounted the details of our two weekly sessions. When I got to the part about the zinc theory, my supervisor immediately exclaimed, "Rob, you blew it big time, and you got to fix this right away." While I had noted that Andrew had reacted to my statement, I did not grasp the significance of my comments to him, which had effectively dismissed his theory. At the beginning of my next session with Andrew, as a good supervisee, I told him that I thought a lot about our last session and that I thought I was wrong about my assessment of his theory about zinc, and that he just could be right. He paused for a moment, then resumed talking about his usual topics. It felt like whatever damage I had done to our therapeutic alliance had been corrected. Winning isn't everything, Josh. Not being the reason for your team losing is everything. When I think about my treatment of Andrew, I am still unclear about whether I actually helped him during the 2 years of intensive psychotherapy we engaged in. However, he taught me a great deal about the process of helping and how one can do harm in that process by making subtle and not so subtle errors in the process. Somehow, I was able to help provide an environment in which Andrew could feel free to express himself, even if it was to the air. I think as a mostly non-judgmental listener, I was able to allow Andrew to discuss his thoughts and theories without being ridiculed or judged. I believe this is especially important for men in therapy due to the generally accepted position that men are more sensitive and fragile than women. We can debate this during question time if anyone really believes this is not the case. In my work with men, I have found it to be essential for there to be a suitable environment free from criticism, judgment, and competition. If for some reason this cannot be created, the patient will not stick around. I do not hate you. You're projecting. For me, a case in point was Ed, a man in his mid-30s who came to me with relationship issues. He had seen a number of therapists, but had not stuck with any of them for long. I was in my first year of practice post-residency. Now, toward the end of my residency, I had begun to wear fancier clothes as I prepared myself for what I imagined to be my post-residency professional life. Suits, a few of them very nice. Designer ties, nice shoes. As I look back on it now, I can see that it was an attempt to look the part, since I was clearly feeling quite insecure. At the end of my third visit with Ed, we are walking towards the door when he turns around, looked at me, and asked, "Who designed your tie?" I recall hemming and hawing for a few seconds, not having been certain what the best response might be. Before I could answer, he flipped my tie over, located the Hugo Boss label, and said, "I thought so." I never saw him again. What I had missed was that I clearly felt insecure, as did he, and that he knew I could not deal with his issues and insecurities if I did not have mine under better control. If this were to happen today, and I usually don't wear ties, so it would be unlikely, I'm sure I would be able to handle the comment in a way without deflecting it that would not hinder the therapeutic process. I'll make a deal with you. You don't push my buttons, and I won't pull your strings. So, over the years, I have continued to be intrigued by what makes men feel comfortable with me. It's not about saying little, that stereotypical neutral stance that analytically oriented psychology and psychiatry have advocated. If anything, I am more talkative and revealing of myself as I have become more comfortable with myself. But it is a slippery slope. If I do share something of myself, it must be within the context of my patients' issues and problems. "It's okay, I've got it." One of my favorites. Chris was a 55-year-old middle manager struggling with an unhappy marriage, two very difficult children, and a mother who was ill. On one visit, well into our work together, Chris was expressing more pain and frustration than I had seen from him in a long time, and he was clearly in need of major venting. Now, Chris is an Irish musician who directs plays in his spare time. I had recently seen the musical Once about Irish musicians, and during a break in his discussions of his problems, I suggested that he might enjoy going to see the performance. He looked at me and said, "What does that have to do with what I've been talking to you about this session?" He had a point. I had no good answer for him, and after fumbling through a mediocre answer, he continued to talk about his problems. Sometimes evidence of a good therapeutic connection comes from way out of the blue. Bill was a 40-year-old executive, happily married with 3 children. I saw him every 3 months to monitor his medication for depression and ADHD. He was quite proper, friendly, but playing his cards close to the vest. After meeting quarterly for about 4 years, as he was walking to the door, he turned back to me and said, "I wanted to tell you that about twice a year I visit this woman who is a dominatrix. I like to be dominated. It feels good. I just thought you should know." I replied, "I appreciate that you told me." Bill had no interest in discussing the details, and he never brought up the topic again. I truly appreciated that Bill had felt comfortable enough to let me know about his predilection. There was clearly no one else he could tell this to. Her eyes, her lips, her skin, all teeming with microscopic organisms. How I've longed for him to touch me an even number of times. Dominic was a 50-year-old sales manager in a small but rapidly growing technology company. Prior to our work, he owned a business which had failed due to his decision to invest his trust with an incompetent partner. In his present position, he was vital to the success of his company, but he felt infantilized by the 2 owners of the company. Dominic's father had died of an MI when Dominic was 5. He and his younger brother were raised by his loving but controlling and critical mother. My early sessions with Dominic were marked by his complaints about how he was treated by his bosses, as well as how he had missed his true calling. He had wanted to be a professor of linguistics. When we would touch upon his father's death and its effects on him, Dominic became quite defensive. The work at times felt like being on a tightrope. Dominic had a very sensitive bullshit meter. He had fired a number of therapists he had assessed as being fake. So I had to be demonstrably real and genuine. Yet he was so sensitive to criticism and rejection that I needed to deliver interventions with a very light touch so as to not send him into flight. After a year of regular visits, Dominic finally told me what he was most afraid of. He felt he desperately needed to confront his bosses about his less than fair compensation package. He was also savvy enough to know that his company was about to take off and the right package could be very lucrative for him. It took another 6 months of delicate work to get Dominic to the point that he called a meeting with his partners. On a side note, I recall one session where I was on the tired side and wasn't as attentive as usual. At the end of the session, Dominic said, "Not too many pearls of wisdom from you today, Doc. I'll see you next week." This is how he talked, in mild version. He must have forgiven me because he did show up the next week, toting a grande latte to ensure my directed focus. This became his ritual gift to me as each session began. At the meeting with his bosses, Dominic presented a convincing argument as to his worth to the company, and he was given a substantially better compensation package. His company did so well, largely due to Dominic's skill, that he was able to renegotiate 2 further significant raises. So you think that Dominic might be happier, more pleasant, even grateful towards me. In fact, he became more irritable and argumentative, questioning the value of further therapy, and complaining even more bitterly about the cost. I tried to continue to let him vent without being critical or judgmental, but it became more difficult due to his increasingly annoying and confrontational stance. What helped me in working with him was recognizing that he was acting like a teenager, which actually represented significant progress in his belated development beyond his stance of an angry, stuck, and scared five-year-old. Then he fired me. But it was okay, because it was time for him to separate and to feel that he could be successful on his own. This is a little hard to read. It's inside the ear of crazy people. Go to the zoo and enlist. Shave your neighbor's dog. Yo, dump your spaghetti on that guy's head. And I've never forgiven him for that thing I made up in my head. Now, some of you might remember our senior musical, which I believe was about 3.5 hours long. During one catchy number, a mashup of Gilbert and Sullivan meets the Massachusetts General Hospital, there was a line which went, "At Harvard, it's essential that one cultivate pomposity." Allen, a college professor in his late 50s, embodied this line, including having been a Harvard grad. At one point, he actually informed me that his Harvard PhD training truly did entitle him to come off as pompous and superior. Allen had real issues to address in treatment: severe marital discord, significant difficulties with cognitive focusing, problems with organizing many areas of his life, as well as mild depression and anxiety. But it was his extreme narcissism that stood out. A typical 45-minute session consisted of 42 minutes of Allen talking and 3 minutes of me trying to provide therapeutic interventions. Early in the treatment, I found myself trying to interrupt him to shape the discussion, clarifying, highlighting, reflecting, supporting. Often my attempts to speak would result in Allen raising his voice over mine until I stopped. He would then continue at his previous volume. So my early interventions were confined to a brief wrap-up at the end of the session, focusing on how the medication regimen was faring and including a few limited comments on material he had discussed. It was clear that patience and waiting would be essential therapeutic tools, as would a stance that involved containing my own irritability at Allen's rambling and at times convoluted logic. Over the first months of treatment, Allen and I fell into a more comfortable pattern. I was able to let him talk and actually came to enjoy parts of our time together, things as basic as being able to rest my overused voice. He also forced me to look at what I did like about him. He was smart, clever, curious about the world, and despite his narcissism, kind-hearted. By letting him control the field, he was able to get his need to be heard satisfied without fear of being criticized, interrupted, or belittled. The more he felt safe, the easier it was for me to become more active in our discussions. He surprised me in his ability to accept feedback and criticism, which resulted in enough change so that his rough edges were softened, his marriage was smoothed out, and his self-image was somewhat improved. Everyone can read that? My own therapist, who I saw in my 20s before medical school, and from whom I first heard the phrase, "all men are little boys," frequently spoke about how it was important to feel love towards his patients. He defined love as the flow of positive regard from one person to another. No matter what type of medicine each of us practices, we are faced with the challenge of making enough of a connection with our patients so that they can feel sufficiently safe and supported in order to tell us about their concerns and troubles. For each of us, it is imperative that our patients feel hopeful and respected in their treatment so they can feel truly cared for. Showing this level of regard can happen during a brief encounter. It can even be done as you type your notes into and navigate your practice's latest electronic health record. a few minutes of attention to the emotional state of your patient, a focus on really catching what troubles them, will result in better care and true collaboration with your patients. How will you ever know whether you're a flying squirrel if you don't give it a shot? Men with their, our, fragile egos and fears of being rejected and judged, and as we have all experienced, their great dis-ease at seeking medical care, need a little extra care and feeding in order to make them feel comfortable and to be put more at ease. During medical school, I often found myself learning from negative examples by observing things I knew I would never do in my own practice of medicine. My favorite example of this occurred during the half day devoted to proctology during our surgery rotation. I don't know if any of you were in the room with me, but if you were, you'll remember this. A small group of us were ushered into an examining room with two doors. Already waiting for us was a male patient on an examining table, back end pointing upward, draped. After what felt like more than a few awkward minutes of waiting, a door flew open, a doctor entered. He walked briskly toward the patient, picked up a proctoscope, lubricated it, inserted it, took a quick look, removed it, put it down, and walked equally briskly toward the other door, saying, "Follow me." From the time he entered the first door to the time he flew through the second door, less than 15 seconds had elapsed. I'm not sure who was more surprised, us or the patient. While this is an extreme example of how not to put a patient at ease, it has helped me to remember the importance of creating a safe, comfortable, and supportive environment. It's easier than you think, doesn't take a lot of time, and can reap enormous benefits in both health outcomes and patient satisfaction. And my last slide, which is, because when you put the Rorschach in your pants, I can't use them again. All right, thank you very much.